素敵な。
Yes, that's me. And my sidekick and former British number one, Mr. John Lloyd. Welcome to Rock and Roll Tennis. I'm here, as usual, with my main man, Mr. John Lloyd. How you doing, John?
Good, good. Always nice to hear from you. It's sweltering hot here, and I believe it's sweltering hot where you are, isn't it?
Do you know what? It is very hot. It's 30, over 30 today, which is very unusual. Wow. It's all going to stop. Tomorrow's going to be back to normal. Rain.
There you go.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the same without that. Come on.
It wouldn't. But nevertheless, things are starting to open up. On the 4th of July, we've got things going. So, listen, we've got a great guest coming on this week, and he's in the picture. And I'm absolutely delighted to get him on. He's a great character. He was a great player. He's now the CEO of the International Hall of Fame, which I'm very keen to hear about. He is, of course, Mr. Todd Martin. Todd, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Keith.
Listen, Todd, I mean, I did mention to Todd before we saw you, John, that Todd has gone the lockdown locks that I've chosen. So I'm setting a bit of a trend here, no?
The sad thing is, this is like 3 weeks worth of growth.
Wow. All right. Well, actually, okay, you're doing well. Listen, Todd, it's great to have you on. You were a great player. You played, obviously, at your height in the 90s. First thing I want to ask you, that was a great era. Of course, yourself was... You got to four in the world, and you had Agassi, Sampras, of course, plus others. And now we've got a kind of different era, but also with like these three marquee players of Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. How do you think the eras compare?
Well, I think the game has changed. So much from a technology standpoint, right down to the way the Grand Slams are seeded and the ranking systems and so forth. So I do believe there's a bit of predisposition of the tour to be exposed to domination. I think the margin for error that the strings produce on any one shot gets our competition to be much more physical and probably a little bit more mental. Whereas, you know, Sampras was far and away the best player of the 90s. And if you caught him on a day where he wasn't right, you could get him. I think for the lower ranked players, Federer, Djokovic, Nadal need to be way off in order to be exposed. And so that margin is just much different than it used to be. I love the way they play. I coached Novak for a year and, I've never been on the tennis court with a better tennis player, in my opinion. The most athletic, just out of this world. And when he's right, I don't think anybody's ever played the game better. Although it's not a diverse or variable style of play, I just don't think anybody's ever played the game better.
Well, we've discussed on here, John said it, we had Johan Cruyff a couple of weeks ago, as great a player as he is, and we know what a fantastic player he is, we've been a little bit, fairly, I think, a little bit critical of him and others in their ability to volley. I mean, that's not, you wouldn't say that Novak is a great volleyer by any stretch of imagination, would you?
I wouldn't say there are too many great volleyers out there right now. I mean,
I agree.
And I think that's Rafa is the most, in my estimation, is the most effective of the prominent players at utilizing the net to his advantage. Yet he's coming in with such advantage that he's figuring out how to win a ton of points at the net, mostly based on what he's done at the backcourt. He's gotten to be a much better volleyer, but you would never compare him to the great volleyers of the 80s, 90s, and before that. If you want to see great volleying, I think you have to watch the doubles game right now and just accept that's not the skill set that is premium like in decades past.
Yeah, but hey, Todd, can I just throw in just something there? If you were teaching someone now, if you had an 8-year-old that came along to you and this is what you wanted to do, how much time, based on the modern game, would you spend on volleys now?
I would spend, I'd have to think about sort of the sequence of how to go about this, but I would spend an unlimited amount of time on the transition game. Because I think that's the core issue. Even when I was playing at my best, when I did well, it wasn't because I volleyed well. I mean, it helped. And I had good volleying days, average volleying days, not so good volleying days. If I had a great volleying day, I was going to be effective. But if I had a great mid-court day, and if I didn't pass up opportunities to get to the net, regardless of how I was volleying, if I was successful at taking the initiative to get to the net when it was appropriate, that's when I was most effective, regardless of how I executed the skill once I got there.
Right.
So there's no doubt, and you see it, I use the example of Rafa, there's no doubt that the sport is going to have more points finished at the net as we go along. Guys are too good athletes, they defend too well. The points are going to go on for too long to really pass up on those opportunities to leave one section of the court and mm-hmm. arrive at the next section of the court.
Yeah.
So in order to get a player to be confident doing that, they need to know how to put racket to ball at the net. Right. They don't need to be Stefan Edberg, though.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Very good point.
This is for John and Todd. I have to say, of the two eras that we're talking about, I preferred your era, Todd. I have to say, and I enjoyed the fact that you could go from the French Open and say someone completely different would win it to thinking who would win the Wimbledon and the US Open, which used to be a leveller. Listen, we just talked about it on here. I think tennis today is a little bit boring, and I think you had a greater variety in the surfaces, the way they played, and obviously the technology. I preferred your era, but I mean, what do you think about my assumption?
I think if beauty is in the eye of the beholder, for sure. I liked my generation better because this generation put me out of a job. And really that transition put me out of a job. I the only guy I played that's the two guys that are still playing are Karlovic and Federer that I played. But that transition and what we've really done is because I do believe a lot of it's attributable simply to the strings that are used. We have created a much more athletic endeavor in tennis than it used to be. And I don't mean athletic in a comprehensive way, but athletic in a ballistic, plyometric, explosivity way. I was between an A and an A-plus athlete from my waist up. Great hands, really good hand-eye coordination, tremendous skill development from the waist down. I was a B-minus athlete, and that might even be generous. I was the slowest human being I ever came across. And I learned how to coordinate myself to where I moved as probably as well as this body would allow me to move. But to imagine trying to match up against Novak and Roger and Rafa with a subpar professional athletic lower body is crazy to imagine. And I think it's just the difference. There would be some people who would, and I remember when we were watching the films from the 70s when we were playing in the 90s and watch Wielander and Noah at the French, and it was like 4 minutes between hits. It was just like the ball was going so slowly. And those two guys just so happened to be two of the best athletes that have ever been on a tennis court. But then you go and you turn on the live tennis and you see Sampras and even Ivanišević, and like it was a lot different. And for us, it was the transition from wood and to graphite and mid-sized rackets and large rackets. So I hope we can put the brakes a little bit on the technological advancements that our sport sees. I don't think we've ever been good at that. And that's one of the reasons why our sport evolves very fast, yet for your eye, not as appealing in the long run.
It's actually just before you said that last couple of sentences, Todd, I was going to ask you precisely that question. That if you were the commissioner of tennis, and obviously we don't have a commissioner, although a lot of people think we should, would you put the brakes, or would you have done it before? Or you know, would you have done that?
Yeah, I think at this point in time, the most telling the best quote I ever heard was when Andre tried polyester string for the first time. We all had just gone over to Europe to play. I think it was in Rome that he tried the polyester string. And Andre was always very low tech on his in his string, but he went out and practiced. Said, "I, you know, let me try this stuff out." And he walked off the court. He's in the locker room, and he said, "Well, I've got two options. The first option is to sign a petition that this should be outlawed today. The second is, I better start using this stuff today." And he started using the strings right then. It's the foresight. It's understanding that, or at least imagining what the actual transition will, or transformation, what that transformation could be, by going from wood to graphite, by going from a 75 square foot, a square inch frame to an 85, to a 95, to 110. I think if it were left up to the players, I honestly think that the players would do really well in governing the evolution of our technology.
Interesting.
I want to ask both of you, because if you had, let's say, a commissioner of tennis or someone, I know that Eurosport has this thing about John McEnroe, the self-appointed commissioner of tennis, but what I mean to say, in all seriousness, was if you had someone who was the head of technology, who oversaw the limitations, a bit like in Formula One. I know that years ago, not that I'm into it anymore, they banned the turbo cars. I guess in a way, I don't want to suggest that there may be people would be lining their pockets, but the manufacturers would be wanting to get their oar in and say, we've got to have this, we've got to have that. How transparent could it be?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to do it now for exactly the way you said. I think if we'd have put the brakes on at the beginning, once we went to graphite rackets, I agree with Todd. I mean, the rackets are one thing, and obviously the technology's changed with the rackets, but it's the strings that have really made the big difference. And if they'd have been right from the start, just a one string pattern, not to be able to mix the two strings together. I'm not high tech at all, so I don't even know all the things that go on. I just play regulation strings, and what the heck's going to do for me? But I do believe, as Todd says, that it has changed the game, and I think in some ways has made it more predictable in so many ways, and has created a sort of more of a one pace or one pattern sort of game. Obviously, there are exceptions to the rule, but for me, and I think you're always guilty of saying your era, you know, is better than the other era, and so on. But I just do believe that this era now, there's just not as much variety in the game, and I think, you know, we should have stopped it quite a few years ago, and I think it's probably too late now. Is my thought.
I would agree that it's too late, but it's not going to be the last time that we have a technological advancement. And so I do think there's a point where you just got to say, let's see what a couple of generations worth of players looks like with consistent technology. The game is always going to evolve. It's got its own challenges, but I look at it, and you brought up the manufacturers. Of course, the manufacturers constantly want the consumer to buy something different. But if you look at other sports, golf, it's the brand on the golf bag. Baseball, there's still, and you guys don't play baseball, but baseball still using wood bats at the professional level. At some point in time, I think it's got to be about brand affiliation for as opposed to literally having to rely on saying, yeah, not only do I play with this brand or that brand, I actually play with Rafa's racket or Roger's racket or Serena's racket. Nobody plays with those rackets because those are custom made for those individuals. So it's just a paint job that they're buying in that the consumer is buying in the end. So I wish we had a little bit more confidence in our sport to just sell itself and be successful without having to constantly push through new barriers.
Yeah, I see. The other thing, Keith and Todd, obviously we've got the technology, but the other thing also, there's enough of a problem in some ways, just the physicality of the game now. And let's be honest, you know, when tennis was invented however many hundreds of years ago, and by who, I can't remember now, the chap or lady or whoever it was that invented it, I think it was some fella from France, wasn't it? But they didn't envision a sport where we were going to have 6'10" players. That was not envisioned. So it's almost like the court dimensions as it is are already kind of wrong for the people that are coming into the sport now, the athleticism and the height. Then you add the technical aspects of it, you know, with all the strings and stuff, and it becomes, I don't know, it's like we're overgrowing it or something. We need to slow it down. I don't know how we're going to do it.
It's an interesting debate. And look, we could talk about the technology and stuff for a long while. There's a few things, obviously, we want to discuss with Todd before he checks out of here. I mean, obviously the Hall of Fame being one of them. But Todd, you got to number four in the world. Now, I'm a big football fan. I know you call it soccer. If you were regarded in the top four players in the world, even the top 20, 30 players in the world, I know John was 21 in the world in singles. You would just think, wow. You were outstanding, both of you. In your sports, you were outstanding. But was there a little niggle in you? You got to two slam finals. Do you still feel, oh, I just wish I could have got over the line in one of those? I'm sure, must have, no?
Well, the niggle, as you reference, of course exists from a, boy, I wish I would have played better at the right time in a couple of matches or in 200 and some odd matches that I lost. but in not from a regret standpoint, it's like at the end of the day, we are a product of our experiences, and without the experiences that I had, I wouldn't be who I am today. I just think that the pain, the failures, the successes, whatever along the way, define who we are and really, really mold us. And I wouldn't want to change that for the world. Although I would like to be a better human than I am today. But I don't think that if I would have held serve one more time in the semifinals of Wimbledon in '96, that would have really changed my life for the better. I was way better, a way better tennis player after 1996 than I was in 1996 when I had my most graphic loss. So yeah, there is a niggle though.
Well, it's funny. A friend of mine said to me the other day, he said, and he's not a tennis fan, he said, "Keith, I was watching a documentary about McEnroe's 1984 Roland Garros tournament and how that still niggles him." And I know that last week when we had Pat Cash saying he walks through Melbourne Park and it does niggle him that his name was not up there and he came close. So I just wanted to ask you that there must be, and there is obviously a little bit of if only.
You know, the bigger if onlys are with respect to relationships. You know, like we all stay really close to certain of our colleagues back from the day. One of our good friends, one of my good friends, is Tim Henman, and you know, we go on vacation with he and his family with some regularity every few years. And the thing that niggles me the most, like I really regret, is that he has a winning record over me. So like, you know, we got our six kids together and Google, and all of a sudden you see the head to head and I'm like, God, that'll eat at me for a little while.
I love it.
Yeah. Did you ever have a match when you're off on your holidays together then?
Only on the golf course.
Ah.
Yeah.
And who wins that one?
I won the last two, okay. But
we'll leave it there, Tom.
I'll freely admit he's better golfer than me, but I did win the last two.
Well, again, I mean, look, I mean, John obviously knows Tim well. I mean, number four in the world he was, and I said to you, John, didn't I? I mean, this is a guy who I think, what a tremendous serve and volleyer, and he didn't win Wimbledon. It just shows you how hard it is.
Yeah, Tim was a fantastic player, and you know, he was obviously close a number of times. And ironically enough, the slam where he actually really could have won was the one that on paper you would have thought he would have had no chance, and that was the French Open when he got through to the semifinals and actually should have won that semifinals. And I think he would have won the finals there. The whole draw sort of opened up. And he had an amazing, would have been the most amazing story ever, because that would have been the one slam that you would have thought that he had absolutely no shot at. And that shows you, you know, the player he was. And when I was Davis Cup captain, I worked with him for a year, and he was fabulous to work with. Very easy on the court. You know, I had him and Tim and Greg Rozetsky. Greg Rozetsky was easy in some ways because Greg knew it all, or at least he thought he did. And so, you know, when he would play, you know, he'd miss 10 backhands in a row, which was his weakest shot. And he'd come around the changeover and he'd say, "Geez, I'm hitting the backhand well, aren't I? I'm hitting the backhand well."
And I would say, yeah, you're hitting it well, but how about on this one you don't come over it and try and just chip it back? And he'd go, yeah, but I'm hitting it well, aren't I? Yeah, you're hitting it great. and so that was Greg. And so, but whereas Tim was more, he had his plan, and he was being coached by Paul Anacone. And Paul just said, I said, look, you know, I'm not going to get involved with someone like Tim. I mean, if he asked me an opinion, but, you know, he's a way better player than I was, and I'm there as his, you know, I believe as a captain, you try and you talk when needed, but you know, the players have got coaches for 40 weeks a year, and the experienced one don't need me mouthing off. And he said, no, just tell him, you know, sometimes I'll give you a signal when he has to be a bit more aggressive or something. I can't remember exactly what he said. And I said, okay. So I remember telling him it like 3-4 times, and finally said, okay, enough already. And so I just turned around and said, look, I didn't say that. Paul told me to tell you that. But I shifted the blame on him immediately and got myself out of it. But he was such a good pro, and he was a hell of a player, hell of a player.
You know, John, I've got to tell you, you talked about Henman winning the French Open. Now, that year, I believe, was 2004. He got to the semi-final, because I had some money before the French Open. I put a bit of a wager on the winner of the French Open and the winner of Wimbledon. The winner of the French Open I put money on was Guillermo Coria, and the winner of the Wimbledon was Tim Henman. Who was the man that Tim Henman lost in the semi-final of the French Open? Guillermo Coria. So there you have it.
Wow.
I lost my money, of course, but never mind. It was a bit of fun. Listen, we've got to talk about the Hall of Fame, Todd. I mean, you're the CEO of the Hall of Fame. It's interesting because I think it is an American thing. Correct me if I'm wrong. You have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I'd love to visit. I'd love to visit the Tennis Hall of Fame, and I will do. Well, what is the process of getting elected to the Hall of Fame?
So the Hall of Fame is, or Halls of Fame, are really and truly a naturally American concept. It's I think it's a concept that continues to broaden, but the most important thing that we do is induct the legends of the game into the annals of history, if you will. But here, we're the in Newport, Rhode Island, we're the home of the original U.S. Nationals. So 1881, what is now the U.S. Open at Flushing Meadows, started here in Newport. We've got a 12,000 square foot museum, which I think is like 1,500 or 2,000 square meters, and it's, you know, it's a spectacular home for the history of our sport. It's an architectural gem. It's got a lot to offer. The process for induction is, first of all, anybody can nominate anybody. So if your Aunt Sally taught tennis to a lot of kids and made an impact on lives, you can nominate her. And then we've got a committee process that ultimately produces three different ballots in certain years. A player ballot, which is, you know, the Sampras's, the Agassiz, the Groffs, the Navratilovas of the world. That's annual. The contributor ballot is every 4 years. And the contributors range from coaches to members of the media to administrators, promoters, and the such. And then we also have a wheelchair tennis category as well, and that's also every 4 years on overlapping years with the contributor category. So a committee of real experts, Hall of Famers, historians, media members, meet in July every year, and they determine what the ballot should look like. All candidates that are deemed to be deserving for the player category, all candidates deemed to be deserving of consideration should be on the ballot. And then that committee is just over 20 individuals. And then the ballot goes out to, depending on the category, between 100 and 150 voters. And of that voting population, 75% of them have to say, yes, they should be inducted into the Hall of Fame for them to be inducted. So,
Have you been to the Hall of Fame yourself?
Well, I've been to the event, and it's a fantastic event, and it's such a great club there, and I love it. And some of the speeches when people are inducted have been just amazing to listen to. I mean, Andre Agassi's one I remember was simply fantastic, and the tribute they give to people that helped get them where they are and all that stuff, very emotional, and it's a wonderful setting for the tournament. And I presume, Todd, that it's cancelled this year, I would imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, we were cancelled a few weeks ago, definitively, but we were anticipating being cancelled. Our governor and our state governor had established that large events were not going to be feasible this summer. So it's a disappointment for us. Conchita Martinez and Goran Ivanisevic were to be inducted in July. What we'll do now is just defer them, and we'll induct them with the class of 2021 next July.
To get more nervous about their upcoming speech.
Well, I think in some ways there was probably a sigh of relief that it, the roller coaster ride of emotion will ramp back up eventually next
year. Yeah.
I want to ask you, Todd, about a Hall of Fame. Is it something that players are particularly proud of? Because we just, you know, spoke privately about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And there's so many shenanigans that go on there. I remember when one of my favourite bands, Guns N' Roses, got inducted. Axl Rose refused to go because he'd fallen out with his bandmates. What is the situation? Obviously, it's not quite like that with the Tennis Hall of Fame. But are the players really proud of being inducted?
To a person, they're incredibly proud. I don't think everybody has full appreciation for the gravity of the honor, sort of the culmination of and the awareness that this is like the ultimate honor for them in the sport. Not that they would trade it for winning Wimbledon, but it is sort of that ultimate last massive honor that that many of them receive. And like anything else, the nostalgia, the emotion of reflection on such an important part of our lives, we all dedicated so much of our time and energy and focus to trying to get really good at chasing around a yellow tennis ball. I think it just depends. I think a lot of them are arrive excited, not certain what to expect from the experience or from their own reaction to the moment. But tears are common, nerves are common, and to a person, I think they all leave here with an experience that probably exceeds what they would have anticipated coming.
Yeah.
John, what did your, yeah. I mean, you're an Englishman, so we just said it's a very American thing. What is your feeling about the Hall of Fame? I'm not obviously meaning to either criticize it or support it, but what is your feeling about the whole notion? I personally, as a fan, would love to get the opportunity to vote, but what is your overall viewpoint?
Well, I think that it the way that they do the voting is the right way, because I think otherwise, you know, you would get, if it was to do with fans, you would get sort of maybe, you know, more sort of I can imagine some players right now that are playing right now that for some fans would love to have them in any Hall of Fame, but they wouldn't deserve it by their record. So I think the way that it's done with the ex-champions sort of picking it and so on, I think is the right way. I think it's a fabulous honour. I mean, and Todd's exactly right. I've known a few players that have obviously got the honour, and I've watched it. And you can't fake emotions. And uh, it,
in some ways, it's a pity that it doesn't get more publicity, actually, because it's the history of the game. And every tennis player that lives loves records. And we've talked about this on a previous podcast. And a lot of the times when you hear players, you know, they turn around and they say they're not concerned with someone breaking their records, you know they're lying, because they love records. And this, it's not a record, but to be honoured and to be put in the Hall of Fame, there are only certain players that get that honour. And it's a tremendous thing. I'm not saying when you take up the game, that's what you strive for. You strive for being number one in the world and winning Grand Slams. But it's pretty darn close. And I think it's a fabulous occasion. I wish it would get more publicity than it does, to be quite honest.
Todd, let me ask you a question, which I think you may or may not want to answer. Could you name me one or two players who are not in the Hall of Fame and you scratch your head and think, how come they aren't in it? I mean, what are the predeterminants of actually getting in it? I guess you don't have to win a slam. You don't have to do X, Y. Are there any predeterminants?
So there's no way in our sport to have a hard and fast criteria for getting in. I have yet to figure out and yet to find somebody in the regular debates that I have with people about the criteria to get into the Hall of Fame and who's in and who's not and all. It is naturally a very subjective consideration. If you look at the players who've been primarily singles players over the years here, who were in the Hall of Fame, I believe every one of them has won a Grand Slam in singles.
Yeah.
Most have been in the top two in the world at one point in time. Rather than talking about those who've not made it in, but are a little bit of a head scratcher, I look forward at somebody like David Ferrer, and I think he's the first guy who I've seen who could turn just the general disposition about analyzing induction on its head. Because here's a guy who never was in the top two in the world, never won a Grand Slam, but he was essentially fourth in the world behind three of the best players of all time for a dramatic amount of time. And he did everything the right way. He came, brought his best every day. And in some ways, I would say that's a sustained level of greatness that few have achieved. It just so happened that he was outmatched by these few individuals.
Yeah, good point.
Anyone you can think of, John?
Not off the top of my head, no. But I think, you know, Todd, you know, with what Todd said, I mean, generally speaking, you know, a Grand Slam, if it's going to be a singles player, is, you know, it's sort of the done thing. There may be exceptions in the future, as Todd said, but generally speaking, I think that's right. I think a Grand Slam, that's the pinnacle of our sport. And if you haven't won one, it will be tough to be in the Hall of Fame, but it may change. But at the moment, I can't think of anybody off the top of my head that I would put in on that criteria. And I think for the main criteria of the Hall of Fame, I do believe you've got to be either the best or close to the best in your category. Otherwise, what's the point?
Todd, would someone like, I mean, she won a slam in the end, but would someone like Caroline Wozniacki have been admitted into the Hall of Fame? She got to number one and she had never won a slam, and everyone said, oh, but she's never won a slam. Could she have, if she hadn't won, I think it was the Australian she won, could she have been admitted into the Hall of Fame?
I don't know that. But yes, I mean, theoretically, yes, somebody who's not won a Grand Slam can be admitted into the Hall of Fame. Had she not won the Australian, I think within the last 2 years of her career, I'm confident that she still would have presented herself as a worthy candidate. whether the voters would have agreed with that it would remain to be seen. And that's sort of, you know, with Caroline, she, before she won the Australian, she had been number one in the world for well more than 50 weeks in her career. I think it's an amazingly compelling case. Would you rather be the best player in the world for 2 weeks, or would you rather be the best player in the world for 52 weeks? And I think that's also in the eye of the beholder. I don't think anybody would trade one for the other, unless you really cut them to their core and see what their true feeling is. But Wozniacki on the women's side, Ferrer is probably the closest, although he never came close to being number one in the world on the men's side.
It's an interesting conversation. Listen, just I have to talk to you very briefly, and John mentioned it, about the Hall of Fame. It's on grass, but it's after Wimbledon. Now, it's interesting. I read the other day that Rafa Nadal wants to have more tournaments on clay. And yet clay is so heavily weighted towards clay quarters. There are, 30-plus tournaments on the ATP Canada that clay. Maybe there's more grass court now, but a few years back there was only six, and you got Wimbledon, supposedly the most coveted title of all, arguably. Why don't you have the Hall of Fame championships pre-Wimbledon and make it as more part of a pre-Wimbledon grass court calendar? It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it's a conundrum for us for sure. Theoretically, and the way you look at the rest of our tour, there is a preseason for each Grand Slam, and then the Grand Slam. The problem for us is we're a tourist destination. The notion of asking people to come from France to Newport and then go back to London, or when there are so many grass court opportunities in mainland Europe and in the UK, from a business standpoint, honestly, I just don't think we could make it. School's not out early enough here to justify having a tournament in the early part of June before Wimbledon. So it's a disappointment. In some ways, but it's also a great celebratory way to start the U.S. summer. We're now part of the U.S. Open Series, in spite of our surface being different. And I think it's good. This way we get to start the summer at the home of the original U.S. Nationals, and we end the summer at the U.S. Open.
How does the grass play on that surface? I don't know if you've played on it, John, but does it play very similar to Wimbledon grass?
Let me answer this first, Lloydie. we just rebuilt our grass courts. We are 3 weeks into playing on new grass courts for the first time in forever. They are not they're not Wimbledon. But they're really good. I just played on Friday for the first time on them, and they're playing well, and they'll be they're a noticeable improvement as to compared to how we were 12 months ago.
John, did you ever play Hall of Fame championships?
I don't believe I ever actually played there. I think I've played some exhibitions there, but I don't think I ever played there that I can remember, but my memory is so bad. But I do remember playing on the courts there, and I must say, I like the courts, because if you could volley well and you could hit some nice short volleys there with a little bit of a slice on them, and they did not come up too well. Sometimes you needed the wedge to get the ball up in the air. Unlike Wimbledon now, where it plays like a hard court, the Newport grass used to be a lot lower. As Todd said, obviously it's changed now, but they were pretty quick and pretty low bouncing, which I liked. That suited my game, so I wish I'd have played it more times, that's for sure.
Well, listen, what can I say? I say it every week. It's such an honour for me as an Uber fan to be able to talk to people like, obviously, John regularly and yourself, Todd. I just want to thank you so much for coming on. We'd love to have you on again. He's so full of wisdom and knowledge, of course, as is John. Yeah, what can I say? When I come to the Hall of Fame myself, I look forward to a personalised tour. And like I said to you, when you come to London, I'll take you and your son to a football match. Although I know that your son is a Chelsea fan, but we don't need to go into that. John's a Wolverhampton Wanderers fan. Have you heard of them?
I have, yeah.
I must tell you a funny story, actually, guys. I've got a friend, he lives in Australia now, and we used to go travelling quite a bit. He's a lovely bloke. Used to go to a lot of tennis tournaments with him. And we'd speak to people, we'd be in Australia or wherever we were, and people would say, oh, what do you follow football? And they'd say, what team do you support? I'd say, you've heard of Arsenal, right? They say, yeah. And my friend Lloyd was a Watford fan, and this was before they had a long run in the Premier League, and he used to say to them, do you know Watford? And people would just look at him and say, no. And it was just one big joke. It's one of those jokes. You've got to be there at the time. And it was just funny. But listen, Todd, you've been fantastic. I know you're obviously, I can see you behind your desk there. Thank you so much again. Gentlemen, Todd, I wanted to speak to you about those sportsmanship awards. Maybe we can do that next time, because I think that is a subject in itself about the likability factor of tennis. Here you got Todd, who was known for his gentlemanly conduct and winning sports awards, and when we've got players today that perhaps aren't, or one perhaps in particular, but getting all the headlines. But I want to talk to you about that next time, if you'd be okay to come back on another time.
I'd be happy to, Keith. Thanks for having me today.
Well, listen, Todd.
Good to see you, Lloydie.
Thanks so much. Care. Have a good
day. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye. Yeah, he's another very nice guy, and I know that he was always known as a nice guy on the tour, wasn't he, John?
Yeah. A damn good player, damn good golfer too. he was in a tough era. I mean, he's, you know, that's for sure. You know, there were some damn good players out. He got close a few times, but he was bloody tough. He was a great ball striker. Obviously, huge serve, but very good feel and power hitter. And as he said, if he'd have moved a little bit better, but it's not that easy when you're 6'4" or whatever, but he'd moved a little bit better, you know, he could have won a few more titles, I guess. He was a damn good player.
You know what's interesting, John, is like when we talk, and then we sort of dig a bit deeper, there are literally so many talking points in the game, and it's great to get them out in the open. I kind of call it like tennis therapy in a way. It's you're getting all the stuff out on the table, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Well, it's been another great episode, and look forward to doing it all again next week. Please remember to press that subscribe button and share with all your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, RNR_tennis, and of course on Instagram, rock'n'roll_tennis. And please leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comments. We will, of course, see you next week, as always. Thanks so much again.